Okay, so we're going to carry on with talking about living an open-hearted life from the book with that title, written by Russell Coates. He's a psychology professor at Eastern Washington University, and me. So we're going to be doing, well, I'll think two chapters today, 46 and 47. They're both quite short, but they're both very interesting. Before we start, let's take a couple of minutes, come back to our breath, let the mind settle and generate our motivation, and we'll have the talk and some time for Q&A. So let's come back to the awareness of our interconnectedness with every other living being. Even if some beings live in different realms, in different environments or places in the universe, still, we exist in relationship to them. And in previous lives and in future lives, we could be very close to them. So with this kind of view, we don't see any living being as inconsequential or as a stranger. We're aware of their kindness, and we're also aware that our actions influence them for the better and or for the worse. When we spend a long time contemplating their kindness, automatically the wish to repay it arises in our mind. That brings forth love and compassion. And if we really want to benefit others, we have to improve our own wisdom and skill and increase our own compassion. As ordinary beings, we're quite limited in how we can benefit, even if there's the wish to do so. So for this reason, we really need to practice the Dharma and cultivate our own potential for the benefit of other living beings. And as a result, have our final goal be achieving the purposes of ourself and the purposes of others by becoming fully awakened Buddhas. So what we're doing this morning is one drop in that bucket. And one drop matters. So chapter 46 is called offering empathy to ourselves and others. Okay, and it looks like it's a chapter I wrote, although at one point I'm going to stop and poke at what is written because I don't understand what the author said. So empathy is crucial in cultivating compassion and in forming and maintaining compassionate connections with other people. Okay, so empathy, we have to be able to understand what other people feel. Yeah, and not just understand it, but understand how what they feel makes sense to them in their context, with their worldview, with their background. So whether we agree with that context or conclusion, we can have some understanding of how that person arrived there. And we start off from that basis of acceptance that that's how they think and feel right now. Yeah. And then with that as a basis, we can start maybe moving forward. Yeah. Instead of greeting them with, "Why in the heck do you believe that? That's dumb." You know, that's not going to facilitate communication. And yet we often start conversations out like that. We're pretty dumb, aren't we? In addition, offering ourselves empathy is very effective in calming and reassuring ourselves when we feel afraid or apprehensive. In this case, offering ourselves empathy means to give ourselves understanding and comfort. Okay, in other words, instead of looking outside and expecting other people to fulfill our needs for confidence or encouragement or comfort, we're able to look inside and give those qualities to ourselves. You know? In other words, we learn how to calm ourselves by seeing things in a realistic way. So having empathy or giving ourselves empathy or having love or compassion for ourselves has nothing to do with pampering ourselves. Okay? It's not, "Oh, poor me, those people mistreated me. I empathize with you so much. You're right, and all those people are miserable to you." No, that's not empathy. That's just sitting in a pity party. Okay, which doesn't really get us anywhere. You know pity parties? Yeah. Yeah, some of us are expert in pity parties. Okay, so let's say, here's an example of offering empathy to ourselves, a supposed example. Let's say we are planning a project together with a colleague, but we have different ways to go about accomplishing it. Our colleague listens to what we say, but doesn't respond to our suggestions. Instead, she strongly urges us to follow her ideas. We give ourselves empathy by reflecting, "I feel frustrated because I desire fairness." Now, this is where I want to stop. And as the person who wrote this, you know, because I wonder if Russell snuck something in. Yeah, this sounds like a Russell phrase. Okay, because how is somebody having a different idea than I have a lack of fairness? Can anybody explain to me what this author meant? Because I don't understand it. Yeah? Uh-huh.
It's like she wanted airtime for her idea and was just overlooked. She didn't get that space. So that's not fair.
What's not fair about it?
There's not equal amounts of time given to everyone's opinion.
So we have to have a time watch. A stopwatch, I mean. Yeah. But the way it's written, it wasn't written like it's because they don't have equal time. It sounds like it's because they have a different opinion. Yeah. So this definitely could have been written better. Yeah. Because people, I mean, what's wrong with people having another opinion? Well, I can tell you what's wrong with it. If it's not my opinion, it's wrong. That's what's wrong with it. But that isn't that exactly what we've been trying to get over during this whole book? Is the idea that everything I think is the best thing and every way I do it is the best way to do it. Yeah. So yeah, if there's unequal airtime, maybe that's unfair. But this isn't clear in here. Okay. So we give empathy by reflecting. They're not listening to my idea. No, that's, sorry. That wasn't written in here. By saying, I feel frustrated because we say this to ourselves, not to the other person. I feel frustrated because I desire fairness. It's a highly held value in my life. So naturally, it's important to me. Fairness in this situation may or may not occur. I can't control the outcome, but I will do my best to express myself clearly and in a way my colleague can understand. I can let her know that while I'm not glued to my ideas, I would like the opportunity to express them and discuss the project with her so that it becomes a mutual understanding. Undertaking. Thank you. Glad somebody's reading the book. Okay, so the rest of that, that's fine, you know, and to explain to yourself and, you know, how you want to work with the person and think that you can explain that to the other person. And the chief thing is not being glued to our way. But whenever I don't know about you, but whenever I go back to it's not fair, there's something in me that's glued to my way, you know, because if it's not fair, there is a big violation going on. Yeah. And for me, somebody having a different opinion is not really a big violation. It's life. Isn't it? You know? Everybody has different opinions. And they just don't know that mine are always the right ones. But why am I surprised every time that happens? Yeah? Are you surprised every time that happens? It happens a million times. And yet, how can somebody see the situation different than I do? Yeah? And they're not even asking me how I see it. They're telling me how they see it. How intolerant I am that I don't want to hear how other people see the situation. I'm only concerned with putting forth my way, the right way. Isn't it true? You know? I think really having compassion and empathy in communication means we have to be able to listen. And sometimes the airtime isn't fair. Somebody has something really weighing on them and they need more time to say what's going on with them. And they can't hear anything we say until they're able to say what they have to say and feel like we've heard it. And in those times, what I've discovered much to the dismay of my self-centered thought, is that I need to shut up. Oh, I should put that more politely. I need to be quiet and listen. But it comes to the same thing. I need to tell myself, shut up, children. You know, this person has something that they need to talk about, and you need to listen to it. And you'll get your own airtime later. Yeah. Have you ever been in a situation where you felt like you really had to say something that was important to you and the other person kept interrupting you and giving their ideas? How do you feel when that happens? Yeah, disconnected. Not heard. Okay. So sometimes we need to be the person who says, my turn will come later, and give the other person the floor. Because that's what they need right now. Instead of barging in and I want to dominate this conversation. So I know of one thing that happens with me if I'm in a meeting situation or even, you know, a small group of individuals. If somebody says something that I think is completely, you know, that it's wrong, I feel like at that very moment I have to interrupt and correct them. Because if I don't, their idea, their opinion might get everybody else's approval. And if that happens, the world is going to be destroyed. Yeah? So I've got to jump in and stop the destruction of the world and let people know that that idea is wrong. Yeah? Even if we're discussing how many cans of tomato sauce to put in spaghetti sauce. Yeah. If they don't have the right number of cans, and if they don't add a little bit of honey to make sure that the tomato sauce isn't too acidic, and they don't want to hear my ideas, then we're really in big trouble. So I better interrupt and tell them they're wrong. Okay. Empathy for them, out the window. Empathy for me, what in the world is that? Yeah, bull in a china shop, I volunteer. Okay. Anybody else have that problem? No. Okay, in addition to empathy, we can extend compassion to ourselves. I don't want myself to suffer, so I accept my frustration and need for fairness without judging myself for having them. I also don't want my colleague to suffer, so I acknowledge that she has feelings and needs as well, even though I don't know exactly what they are at this moment. Why don't I know? Because I haven't shut up and listened. But I don't say that to myself when I'm giving myself empathy. We remind ourselves that everyone equally wants happiness, not suffering, and that we shouldn't see planning this project with our colleague in a narrow way, such that if her ideas prevail, she wins and I lose. That I agree with. You know, when we see every difference of opinion as a contest of who wins and who loses. Yeah, that really gets us into a very, very tight mental space where we easily feel threatened, we easily feel put down, and disregarded. But it's not that that is coming from the situation. It's coming from the way that we are framing it in our own mind, that this is a contest of whose idea wins and whose idea loses. Instead of, you know, there's a bunch of ideas here, and we can work together to figure out what's going to work best for us and work on it together and build on each other's ideas. And I don't know about you, but the thing I find most rewarding is when I can have an exchange with somebody and really build on their ideas and my ideas. Yeah. Instead of it being a contrast, a contest. Yeah. So I really dislike, and it happens sometimes here, when people say to me, "What do you want?" Yeah. As if I'm a dictator and I can, you know, whatever I say goes and nobody's going to move unless I say something. I don't think that's very healthy. And I also, you know, it's not healthy for the community. And also, it puts me in a very strange place. What do you want? You know, well, sometimes I don't know what I want. You know, I mean, I know I have an opinion factory that operates 25/8, but there are some topics that my opinion factory hasn't gotten around to forming opinions on. And if you ask me for an opinion on that, I often don't know. Okay. I remember when we moved here back in 2003, and we were just moving in, and so people had silverware, and they were putting it in the drawers in the kitchen. And they were coming to me, "Which drawer do you want the silverware in?" Yeah. In the little dividers, do you want the forks on the left or on the right? Yeah. Where do the napkins go? Do you put the big spoons and the small spoons in the same thing, or do you want them in different? You know, I really don't have opinions on that at 8 o'clock in the morning on the first day when I'm moving into someplace. You know? Yeah, just put them somewhere for now. And after a while, if I don't like it, I'll move it. Yeah. Instead of, you know, like, let's have a discussion of, you know, do you think the soup spoons and the teaspoons should go in the same, you know, partitioned area, or the big ones in the teaspoons this way? But sometimes the teaspoons don't fit in when you put them sideways in the smaller one, do they? Yeah. So what do you do then? Okay, we better have a planning meeting about this. So instead of seeing the two parties on opposite sides of the table quarreling, we use a different image. Both of us are on the same side of the table looking at the problem together. And this really makes a big difference. Okay? When it's me and you and we're discussing the image, yeah, we're face to face and we're going to have different ideas. If we're sitting side by side and the problem is there, then we talk about it together and come up with an idea of what to do in the situation. And I like that much better. Yeah. And I think you come up with much better results when you do that. We suggest this new image to our colleague. When initially she may not see the situation that way, we can continue to emphasize the points we hold in common and respectfully restrain ourselves from reacting in ways that may cause her to feel uncomfortable. like telling her, you're closed-minded and why don't you be quiet and listen to my idea? Yeah, nothing like an accusation, telling somebody about a quality you think they have. Yeah, real good way to promote friendship. Okay. Offering her empathy and compassion will help her to consider this new image of us working together to solve the problem. Yeah. I think, you know, that image, I don't know that it would need a lot of persuasion to encourage people to look at that, because it really deflates the ego intensity of the situation. Of course, there are some people who like confrontational encounters. And I worked with somebody who was like that. And that they defined themselves, you know, so often in who they were opposed to. And so everything, you know, so many discussions became oppositional like that. It was not very comfortable. And we stopped working together. Yeah, that was one reason. To understand the difference between giving empathy and compassion on the one hand and blame on the other, consider these four different ways of responding to an unpleasant situation. Okay, so think of an unpleasant situation. Yeah, it can range from where do you put the spoons to, you know, how are you going to bring up children, or what are you going to present as the Buddhist speaker at an interfaith, you know, some situation. So four ways of responding when you're talking to somebody else about this. Okay, first way, blame the other person. Yeah, why do we have this problem? You did this, you did that, or the other person did that, but you didn't correct them, and it's all your fault. Okay, that's kind of our usual way. Well, not always. The second way, yeah, is blame ourselves. Yeah, oh, look what I did. I should have noticed this beforehand. What's wrong with me? Okay. So there's two words that I think should be eliminated from the English language and also from my own mind and from all of our minds. Okay. Those two words are blame and fault. Because when there's a problem, what do we first do? Whose fault is this? Who are we going to blame? And we like to have one person, yeah, that we can dump everything on, who is the source of all of our problems, because that makes our life so easy. Then we have no responsibility. It also disempowers us, because then we can't do anything, because it's the other person's fault. Which means they have the ability to make it good or bad. And if they have the ability, then I don't. So all I can do is feel sorry for myself or get angry and blame them and yell and scream. And scream, it's not fair, you know? Yeah. The first phrase we learn as children, yeah? Especially if you have siblings. Isn't it? First thing, it's not fair. Yeah. When I was that age, you didn't let me do this. My brother's that age now. You let him do it. It's not fair. God, how did parents endure that? I don't know how my parents put up with that. Yeah, Well, sometimes they didn't. And I won't tell you what happened then. Okay, you can imagine. Okay, so those two, blame the other person, blame ourselves. Third one, offer empathy and compassion to the other person. Okay, so difficult situation. Yeah, offer them some empathy and compassion. Hear them out, try and understand them. Or offer empathy and compassion to ourselves, yeah? Which doesn't mean telling ourselves we're right and isn't the world unfair because this other person isn't listening to us. That's not empathy for ourselves. That, again, is self-pity. Okay, for example, Carl asked his friend John to help him do a home maintenance project on Saturday. Okay. So John agreed, but an hour before the appointed time on Saturday, he called Carl and apologized, explaining he had another commitment that day that he had forgotten all about, but he could still come the following Saturday to help. This happens all the time, doesn't it? Yeah, somebody says they're going to help you with something, and then at the last minute they call and they can't come for whatever reason. So Carl was now stuck. He had already removed the old shower stall from the bathroom, and without John's help, he could not install the new one. Uh-oh. Since this was the only shower in his home, it put him in a stinky situation. In the first option, Carl blames John. What do you mean you have another appointment? You told me you would come. You should remember your appointments and not make commitments you can't keep. Now, because of you, I won't be able to take a shower for a week. Okay, so imagine what that kind of response would do to their friendship and to both Carl and John's sense of well-being. No. In the second option, Carl blames himself. I don't know what's wrong with me. All my friends desert me when I need them. It's my fault for trusting John in the first place. Why am I so gullible? This response adversely affects Carl's self-esteem as well as his friendship with John. Okay, so that one doesn't work very well either. With the third option, Carl gives John some empathy and compassion. You're my friend, and I know you're a person with integrity. I imagine you feel disappointed because you would like to keep your commitments, and in this case, you aren't able to. Wow, isn't that nice? Yeah? Could you imagine being John and somebody saying that to you when you just blew it? Somebody being really, you know, understanding. And not only understanding, but saying, you're my friend and I know you have integrity, praising you. Okay. So here Carl is focusing on John's feelings and needs. Carl sees that he isn't the only one adversely affected by John's forgetfulness. Yeah. Because John probably does feel bad. He's letting his friend down. With the fourth option, Carl gives himself empathy and compassion. So saying to himself, yes, this is inconvenient, but it's really not the end of the world. You know, disaster. I feel disappointed because I need reliability, but I'll be creative and figure out what to do. I know his inability to come today is a simple oversight, and he'll be here next week. Yeah? So you see, it's a way of talking to oneself that's much more in line with reality, you know, giving the other person some space. Yeah, acknowledging that in general they are reliable. Acknowledging that, you know, you can devise something. And, you know, there's certainly more somebody else that might be able to help you put the new shower in. Yeah, on short notice. And, you know, and even if you can't, you take sponge bath. It's okay. Yeah, you don't need to, you know, go ballistic over this kind of thing. Okay. So here Carl avoids projecting false motivations and meaning onto John's inability to come and accepts the situation, maintaining the friendship and approaching the problem with a sense of creativity. So it's a good outcome, isn't it? Yeah. He's not blaming himself, so he maintains his own self-esteem. He's maintaining the friendship. He's maintaining his regard for the other person's good qualities. He knows the situation will work out, and he knows that he's a creative person who can come up with alternatives. So that's really a win-win, isn't it? So it's strange, isn't it, that we so often go to the lose-lose of blaming the other person, where we hurt their feelings, we are mad ourselves, and think that the situation can never get remedied, and the friendship is broken. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I don't know if it's just because we copy what we see, you know, in the other people around us who talk like this, or if we just have a lot of habit of speaking like this that we even bring with us from previous lives. Yeah. Okay, then the reflection for this is think of a conflict you've had with somebody recently. Go through the four options of how you could respond, imagining each of them in turn. Yeah, so one situation, and then just play, blaming the other person, blaming yourself, empathy and compassion for them, empathy and compassion for yourself. And so think of a situation that actually happened. Okay. So how would you feel after adopting each of those four situations? And what are the advantages of adopting an empathetic or an empathic and compassionate approach for both the other person and for yourself? Okay. So I think this will be part of your discussion in the afternoon. So let's do the next chapter, too, because it's very short, and it's called Humor. Yeah, so this is also one I wrote. Sometimes we aren't able to separate our feelings and needs from a situation itself. Sometimes. How about most often? Desperately wanting something, we are filled with attachment and craving and grumble until we get what we want. Because we deserve it. And it's only fair that we get it. Right? I'm glad you agree with me. I'll remind you next time we don't agree on something. Okay. In this case, we feel dissatisfied and our self-centeredness is making a relatively small thing seem very serious. Instead of berating ourselves for how ridiculous our thoughts and emotions are, we can introduce some lightness and humor into our way of looking at a situation. Okay? And if you look, again, I don't know about you, but with me, many of the things that I just get angry and irritated about are teeny tiny things that I will not remember next week, let alone next year. But at this moment, yeah, I am irritated about that. Okay. And when you can stop yourself and say, look at, you know, the universe is so huge and the dukkha of samsara is so humongous. And here I am focused on my shoelaces breaking. Yeah. And the shoelace broke now, and I go, I don't know where they store the other shoelaces. I don't know if Venerable Yeshe put them somewhere before she left, or who's in charge of storing the shoelaces. Oh, her. Okay, now I have to go ask Venerable Kunga where the shoelaces are. Last time I asked her where the toothbrushes are, it didn't go very well. Let's see, how am I going to do this? And I spend some time trying to think, you know, maybe I should offer her some chocolate and then go ask. Or maybe I should make three prostrations, bend down and put my palms together and ask where the shoelaces are. Or maybe I should just go ruffle through everything in the storage room and risk her wrath afterwards because I made a mess and didn't clean it up. This is a big problem. Okay, so when these kind of things happen, this is where I feel humor is so important. You know, because you look at this huge problem and then you make fun of yourself. Yeah, you make fun of yourself. How silly I am that I take this insignificant thing of my shoelace breaking and not knowing where the new shoelaces are and make it into this incredible, huge thing, even going so far as to say, I think she hid them. Oh, that's even worse because I saw some. Yeah, people sent some of those new kind of shoelaces that are stretchy ones. They sent more than one packet. I know we have them. Did you? Did you all take them? Is that why I don't have any shoelaces? Who took them? One, two, three, four. Oh. Oh, thank you. You saved the day. Okay. But you see what our mind does? Yeah. And all of a sudden, I am imputing motivations to her that are completely off the wall. Yeah. I get the whole community involved. Yeah, because I want to know, is what she said really true, that other people took them? Yeah, and I want to know who has them. And then I'm going to ask those people one by one if they've used them yet or if they're just sitting in the bottom of their drawer. And then I'm going to go back to her and ask her why she hasn't asked to put more of those on the wish list. Yeah. Because she should have done it. And she'll tell me that she tried to, but Venerable Chudney said, we already put them on the wish list once. We're not going to put them on again. And then I have to go to Venerable Chudney and have another one of our long discussions. Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, when I can look at myself and what I'm doing, the whole situation becomes hilarious, doesn't it? You know? And when you sit with it for a long time, you can come up with a really good skit. And that's precisely why we have skits here, because it's really healthy for us to know how to make fun of ourselves, you know, and how to take something that we are very sensitive about and make a skit out of it. Yeah. And I really applaud those of you, you know, who have done that. Yeah. Can I make an example, Stephen? No, many years ago, we did a skit about your family and whether they would give you permission to ordain or not. Yeah. And you went along with it, and we really hammed it up. And it was great. And I don't know about you, but I feel like it really relieved a lot of the tension in the situation. Yeah. Was that true for you too? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And we did another one.
You knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where, what were you? You were the mother and your daughter wanted to ordain?
Was no,
that?
I was the daughter.
You were the daughter.
And, are you speaking about the one in Spanish?
Yeah, there's been a few. You know, because there was one where you were the mother, I think. Yeah, anyway, yeah, there's been many of them. Yeah, but she is wonderful when she, you know, you play, in my memory, playing the mother, it was fantastic. And part of it was in Spanish, yeah? And you were pulling your hair out. Look what my daughter's doing, and on and on and on.
That was Cynthia. Cynthia was the mother. I was the child. I was the one that was ordaining. And Cynthia would just, she went Broadway star. She pulled a Broadway show.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the two of you together, you know. And so, again, with that kind of situation, it really diffuses any kind of energy. Yeah, because she has a daughter and things come up with your daughter that are difficult. And so being able to act things out like that, yeah. So it was Venerable Wu Yin who had the idea for us to do skits. And when we had the program Life as a Buddhist Nun in Bodh Gaya in 1996, she had the nuns do skits. And they were hilarious. And they brought out, just as she had wanted, things that we felt were difficult about our roles as nuns. Yeah. So I won't tell you right now the plots, but they were really good. Okay. You were there. You remember them? You remember Venerable Drime being the Rinpoche? Yeah. Okay, that's the one that really sticks out for me. Anyway, okay, so humor can really, really help us, yeah? Okay, so instead of berating ourselves for how ridiculous our thoughts and emotions are, we can introduce some lightness and humor into our way of looking at a situation. This is a great way to show compassion for ourselves. Yeah, humor is a good way to help ourselves through difficulties and to gain perspective on the situation's actual gravity and realize that it's really not such a huge thing. Okay, for example, Bill recognized that his self-centered mind craved the acknowledgement and appreciation that he believed he deserved but was not getting from those around him. Anybody else resonate with this? Rather than criticizing himself for being so self-centered, he imagined the following exaggerated scene. His boss, parents, colleagues, and friends surrounded him, clapping, cheering, throwing confetti, and exclaiming the praises of all of his abilities. Yeah? Yeah. They took out a gold crown and, bending on their knees, anointed him their king. He imagined basking in the glory, his gloating, self-centered mind being totally satisfied. Okay. Then he naturally started to laugh at the absurdity of the image and his desire for acknowledgement. Okay. So this just, you know, you imagine these absurd things. And then you laugh at yourself. So I'll reveal one time when I did it. So I was in retreat. Yeah, this was many years ago. Long time ago. So I was in retreat, and I was sitting there meditating. And I was recovering from Italy. So my meditations were mostly about anger. Well, yeah, and a little bit about the antidote to anger. And then I started thinking, oh, I'm such a good meditator. Look at me, I'm sitting here, good meditation position, really focused, concentrated. My teacher has supernormal powers. And I'm sure he's looking right now and he knows what a good practitioner I am. And I thought that, and then I just burst out laughing in the middle of the meditation session because it was so ridiculous. You know, what a ridiculous thing to think. Yeah. So it totally, you know, it diffused it. No. Okay. So humor, you didn't laugh at that. Humor can be really useful when applied to ourselves, but it's best to avoid using it to make light of others' feelings unless they've enlisted our help in viewing the situation from a humorous perspective. Okay, I make that mistake a lot. I try and bring humor into a situation when the other person hasn't invited it. Okay. These people, why can't they learn to laugh at themselves? Okay, when others feel vulnerable, it's easy for our well-meaning attempts at humor to be perceived as ridicule. So one time, after one retreat, we were doing skits. I think you might have been at this retreat. And the woman who was working in the office when we started doing the skits, they were really funny. But one skit was about going to the person in the office and, you know, you're in retreat and you complain because your shoelaces broke and because this is wrong and that's wrong. And she, you know, heard the skit and she got furious. She stomped upstairs and just said, I was trying so hard to help you people and now you're making fun of me. And nobody was blaming her, you know? Nobody at all was doing it. We were laughing at the whole situation, actually, of how sometimes when you're in retreat, your mind goes crazy and makes big things out of little things, yeah? But she took it very personally. Yeah. Yeah. I won't tell you that story. Okay, so here's the reflection. Recall a situation in which you really wanted somebody to feel and behave a certain way towards you, but they were feeling and acting the opposite way. Okay. Ham it up and exaggerate the situation. Turn it into a humorous skit in which the person feels and does everything you want and even more. Imagine the entire world reorganizing itself to serve your wishes with you as the queen or king. Allow yourself to laugh at the absurdity of how you previously felt and acted. Are you volunteering to do that?
Do what? If I may be excused today from doing that, Venerable.
You're going to tell me to be quiet now, huh?
I will respectfully ask the Venerable Abbess to
shut up.
To leave. To leave. I thought she gave me the nod. I thought I totally saw her nodding, and I thought maybe she's calling me. So I jumped over. No, Venerable. Excuse my
yes.
mistaking your nod as a clue to come up and do this. Speaking of humor, this is a very good opportunity to try humor.
I know, Venerable, that you are my friend and that you would never really tell me to be quiet. Because you know that I never say anything that is totally unnecessary, and I never talk too long. And I know that you know this. Okay, no, please let me prostrate to you. Oh, my. Oh. Okay. You only did 3 prostrations? Come on, stop making a scene. Okay, so I guess we better stop for lunch.